water.
Good morning. I don't think these are on. Is this working? Okay. Good morning. Is it not working?
No, I can't.
Senator Rest's microphone won't reach her. Maybe someone can help, but we'll get to that. Mr. Chair and conferees, we thought it was really fruitful Saturday to just hear kind of the thoughts on a number of Senate provisions, and, you know, we didn't act on them, and we didn't take public testimony on them, but we just thought it was helpful to understand your perspective on a lot of provisions that we're not carrying. And so we thought at least this morning we'd do the same thing, and I know we'll be coming back, but I don't know when because we both have the floor. And so we intend to adjourn by floor at 12 for us, right? 12:30 for you. Okay, so we'll recess by 12 for sure, and we'll come back later. But we thought this morning we wanted to talk about Representative Hansen's work on sand silica mining taxes, and then we have some provisions on the estate tax and gift tax that you don't have. So these would be pieces that you don't have, and we just learn about them and then recess. So if that's okay,
Madam Chair,
Senator Rest,
there was one provision in the public finance bill that we skipped over, that I visited later with the that's in your bill, not ours, that I visited later with the department on, and at some point we'd be willing to accept that and get that off the.
If you know the motion, we could take the motion. I don't know it, but people want to get that done before we forget. But or do you want to wait?
Okay,
Senator Rest.
I can find it quickly enough. Starting page 8, it was the one that had benefits in it. Article 12, Section 3 of the House, which was the special assessments for energy improvements that eliminates a reference under the Energy Improvement Financing Program enacted by the 2010 legislature that the properties must be, quote, benefited, et cetera. And having visited with the department, I would now move the House provision on that.
Okay, thank you, Senator Rest. Does everyone understand that? Did you get that, Ms. Pollack?
Article 12, Section 3 of the House.
Section 3 on page 84.
Do you want it to?
Is there a problem with
heard,
it?
Mr. Michael, there was an interest in making it effective immediately. Mr. Michael, did you want to comment on, was that the difference?
Yes. This provision in the general public finance bill would become effective July 1st, just like all of the other provisions in the public finance bill. Some of the proponents behind this have said there are pending financings that they could actually do in May and June if you made it effective immediately.
Madam Chair, that would be my motion.
Okay, thank you, Senator Rest. Discussion. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed say nay. The Rest amendment, the Rest motion is adopted. Senator Skoy.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I'm going to notify Senator Schmidt's office of the hearing today, so maybe he can sit in with
sure.
us. He was the Senate author of a number of the frac sand proposals.
Okay.
I don't know if he's here yet this morning or not.
Great. And I should say, you know, we thought just like you weren't taking public testimony on your provisions, we weren't going to either. But we would be happy to have Senator Schmidt join us. I'm not sure if he's the Senate author of this bill, however, but I will tell you there's a lot of silica sand issues in front of the legislature this year, but this is not those environmental kind of issues. This is just the tax piece. So,
Madam Chair.
Senator Skoy.
He was the Senate
Okay,
author.
Great. That would be great if he we thought if that's okay with you on the Senate side, the best way is just to have our author explain it to you, and he's done a lot of work and changed the bill lots of times and has worked with the department, and so we just want to have Representative Hansen just talk to you all about what he's attempting to do in this bill that we're carrying. And it came out of Chair Dabney's division, And then it's changed a few times along the way, but so now it's in the full omnibus tax bill, so if that's okay.
And Madam Chair, perhaps you could direct us to the language in the House bill so I could track with that.
Mr. Hines, or does somebody know the page numbers in the House bill?
Article 11.
Article 11.
Section 1.
Yeah, just say the page, though.
Page.
188 of the House bill.
Page 188. Thank you, Mr. Biggerstaff. Okay. So Representative Hansen, we've in tax on the House side, we've heard this a lot. So just like you all have thought a lot about conservation easements and PILT and all kinds of things that we weren't really thinking about, we've been working a lot on this one. So Representative Hansen, good morning. We're glad you're here.
Members of the conference committee, my first time, I think, between the or being in front of the tax conference committee, so experience for me. As Chair Lincheski had mentioned, we have spent a lot of time on silica sand in the House, and maybe a little background to give some perspective of where we're at. There were several bills introduced in the House, but what was not introduced in the House was a moratorium or a generic environmental impact statement. We did not introduce those, they were not introduced. What was introduced, there was a bonding proposal that Senator Schmidt was also a co-sponsor for, looking at purchasing easements, and I know you've talked about easements for wellhead protection and unique natural features like trout streams. And House File 906, which is carried generally in both the House and the Senate and is in the Environment Finance Committee. One difference that the House has in that Environmental Finance Conference Committee report is the creation of a special revenue fund to pay for some of the silica sand activities that are in House File 906 and in comparable Senate language. As the author in the House, I have said repeatedly, much to some of my green friends dislike, that I did not support a moratorium or a generic environmental impact statement. I have stated that I believe that the industry, the private industry, should pay for the public cost of this newer endeavor that we're venturing on in Minnesota. And that public cost relates to roads. That public cost relates to air quality. That public cost relates to water quality responses. And so what we did on the policy side is we created a technical assistance advisory team, which language is also carried in the Senate, and we have that operating through the Environmental Quality Board, feeling that they are the best agency to get the other agencies to work together to provide that technical assistance to local units of government. Those local units of government were here asking for help to deal with the emerging industry. Now, we know that sand mining has been occurring in Minnesota for a long time. And the definitions, and we had quite a debate about this on the House floor, the definitions that we have for silica sand are very specific and relate to the silica sand being used for hydraulic fracturing for gas and oil production. That's in the House language. It explicitly says that. So we're not talking about foundry sand. We're not talking about glass making. We're talking about this new and emerging market that, because of the quality of our sand and because of the proximity to the Dakota oil and gas fields, we have an opportunity in Minnesota to do mining and to have a strong environmental protection.
Excuse me. I think Chair Skoy has a question, but can everyone here rep some Hansen? Okay.
I'll bring it a little closer.
Yeah, you really have to. Yeah. Okay, so Senator Skoy.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Hansen, how do you differentiate in the mining process what the use of the sand is going to be? Because my understanding of this is that this sand could be used for fracturing or it could be going to make glass, and it's the same silica sand. So how do we differentiate those uses?
Some Hansen.
Madam Chair and Senator Skoy, it's a commodity like selling corn. I mean, you have way tickets, you have a sale where it's going, and you can apply that processing tax. We have, I think the better way to back up just a bit, we have three different methods of recovering dollars. One is the existing aggregate silica sand tax that is a local option for counties right now. And I'll get back to that in a moment. We have an extraction tax. So that is based on a cubic yard, so that when there is the taking of that sand, when it's mined, you're mining it on a ton before it's raw sand, before it's processed. And then you have the processed sand where it's been washed, and then it's ready to be used. And I think many of you may have had examples or been given little jars to see of what that silica sand is like. So there's three different taxes in there. What we do on the aggregate silica sand tax is we allow the local units of government to go up to 30 cents a ton to recover cost. Right, currently it's 15 cents a ton to recover costs for local roads and for managing that. So that's a local option. It's currently 15 cents. I believe that was last changed in 2008, if my memory is correct. The extraction tax, we have mining that's occurring where you have sand being mined. That's where that would apply. But if there is the aggregate tax at the local level, that's credited back so that they're not paying a double amount. Then on the processing tax, we have a 3% processing tax, and the model was the kind of the severance tax that's been used with iron mining in the past, but it's, I realize it's not exactly the same, but it's that's the model that we were looking at on taconite. So you're applying a tax to that silica sand that's been processed. We have in there a incentive so that if it's an enclosed facility or if they have proper best management practices, they're not using the roads, they have air quality under control, they would go to a 1% process tax. So that's a long way of explaining back to your question. The processing tax and the extraction tax can be applied at the end market for that commodity. Your aggregate and your silica sand tax would be applied if the local government chooses to go up or if they remain the same.
But, Senator Scott. But Madam Chair, Representative Hansen, I thought I heard you say that you would only tax the sand that was being used for hydraulic fracking. And if I didn't hear that correctly, could you correct me?
Yes, and that's in the on the process tax and the extraction tax, which would be the new taxes that are in the bill.
And Madam Chair, how do you differentiate at the pit where the sand is going to be utilized? That's the question.
Is that where the tax is imposed?
Yeah. When do you impose the tax unless you know where it's going to go and how does that mechanism going to work?
And Madam Chair, I don't have the exact language in front of me, but I think it has some descriptions of where that tax is applied.
Mr. Biggerstaff, do you want to direct folks to where in the House bill to answer Senator Scoia's question?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, the definitions on page 190 define silica sand as the type of sand used for hydraulic fracturing. I don't know that there's anywhere in the bill that deals with where the product ends up, though.
Where did they impose the tax?
Section 4.
Section 4.
Senator Rest, did you?
I think, so at what point in the transactions with regard to silica sand being used for fracking is the tax imposed? And is that then on page 191?
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yeah,
and how does that work?
Mr. Biggerstaff. And you can tell us lines as well here now.
Sure. Madam Chair, members of the committee, on line 191.7 mm-hmm. is the mining and storage tax. That's the tax that would be imposed on the extracted material as well as material stored in stockpiles. Mm-hmm. And then if you move to 191.14, that's the processing tax. So that tax would apply to sand after it's been processed at a processing facility.
And Madam Chair?
Yes.
Mr. Bigger?
Bigger staff.
So in the mining time, you're going to be imposing a tax as the silica sand is mined. But the company probably won't know at that point if it's going to be used for making glass or for going off to fracturing for oil or gas production. When does that differentiation occur?
Madam Chair and members, I'm not sure, and I don't know if Mr. Michael has anything.
Michael?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, the bill does not differentiate what the end use of. The only way that fracturing enters into it is in the definition of silica sand. If you want to exempt the end use, I think what you could do, as Representative Hansen was suggesting, since there are records as to, you know, where they sold or what uses were put to it, you could put an exemption with a refund mechanism or a credit mechanism or something like that, if the goal would be to say we don't want to tax sand that's used in glass making or other industrial processes or for bedding and that sort of thing.
Representative Hansen.
Chair, I think the means, if you keep going through section 4, and
what page are you on?
I'm
now?
On page
191
and 192. 191
and 192. Right. Sorry, you were.
You have definitions there of reports, registration, reporting, extension. So there's a mechanism for recovery. I do want to point out one additional thing relating to the tax and what we had done with processing. I believe with extraction is when we look at issues in the state, we have mining and storage issues. Two of the issues that I think maybe you've heard testimony on in the Senate is storage piles that are not, for example, in Winona, where sand comes across the river, it's stored, and it blows. And so you've got the transportation issues and the air quality issues that may not be associated with extraction, because it's not extracted at that site. It's extracted in Winona or in Wisconsin. It's coming across the bridge. It's being stored before it's transported out. But there's public cost for Minnesotans at that point. A similar place would be in Wabasha, or where we have other sites where sand is being moved. And the management practice that we want to encourage is to have a facility that doesn't blow. We want to make sure that we're not having the impacts, or that those impacts are recovered through the tax to cover those management practices, to cover the transportation cost. That's what we're attempting to do here with these variety of taxes. Is it the perfect solution? I think that there are ways that we can move towards getting those public costs covered. With the taxes, we may not be there yet exactly in this bill, but we've been trying to change with the input we've been receiving from the industry and from the local units of government. So when we look at the problem, we have the mining of sand, which starts to grow with the new uses, primarily for hydraulic fracturing. We have increased costs that are associated with that for Minnesotans. When we have storage, because we have the transportation capacity here, then we've got some additional cost, both with the transportation system, but with the public health system with air quality. So we're trying to capture into those types of the supply chain, the mining chain, the commerce chain of sand, cover the public costs. That's what we're attempting to do here, and we're using three different methods to do that. We're hearing from locals they need some more assistance, so we're giving them the option to raise that. We're having the extraction tax to try to cover, and we're having the processing tax to try to cover on models that we've used elsewhere.
Senator Senjum.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Hansen, just maybe follow up a little bit, go a little further in the weeds. At some point, and I'm thinking about the pile of sand in Winona, which is owned by somebody, and it seems to me at there needs to be some differentiation, and maybe there is within your bill, about when the public responsibility starts and when the and where the private responsibility. It would seem to me, for instance, at Pyle of Santa Winona, that the engineering controls associated with containing blow, if you will, are the company's responsibility as opposed to the public responsibility. Is there anything in the bill that sort of differentiates some of this?
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Senator Senjum, well, in the House and Senate files that we've passed, we have provisions in there for rulemaking for air quality for the Pollution Control Agency and the Department of Health. We actually, Wisconsin is farther ahead than we are on air quality and reclamation standards. They've done the rulemaking. We direct in the policy bill, which then this bill will help pay for, rulemaking for air quality, working with the Department of Health on health standards, and then reclamation standards for the actual mining.
Senator Senjum.
That's fine. I do have another question, but let's stay on this topic.
Senator Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And we did have some discussion in the Tax Committee with regard to this sand piles. And from I serve on the Environment Finance Division also, so I heard all of this in that division. It appeared to me that part of the problem with regard to the sand piles is that they're located on railroad right away. It's a question as to whether even the state has the authority to regulate those piles. Now, we think we probably have the right to tax that property. I don't know about the taxing of the sand that's being delivered there, probably. But regulating those sand piles appears to be a problem. And so I appreciate your effort. I've highlighted here what you've done here, where you're taxing the sand that's being transported in. I think that in my, you know, we didn't have extensive hearings on the tax. I did read through and consider it some. I think that in the scheme of things, we probably do not want a compounding tax, a tax on the mining and then a tax again on the processing, because, and I see he is the proposal here exempts folks that do not transport by truck. That's good, because we want to encourage these to be these self-contained units. I think that we should be contemplating whether we should be figuring out a mechanism for encouraging rail spurs into these sand mines as they go along the Mississippi River. The analogy that I think of is when the Burlington Northern went to these unit trains, so every little elevator couldn't get a couple of rail cars pulled up next to it to deliver grain. Many of the elevators then pooled their resources together and put a rail spur off to a loading facility with large grain storage handling capabilities. And the train comes by with their 57-car unit trains or 109 or whatever they're doing. They back in and then they load that unit train. That's the way the rail system is going to work. So if there's any way in this tax proposal, if we could be encouraging that, I think should be contemplated. So I think there's a lot of stuff going on here. I have done a fair amount of thinking about this, and so I don't know that we have the answers today. I certainly think we can continue to work on it. I do want to just ask a question, unless maybe we should stay on the railroad right away for a little bit longer, because I think that is a problem that nobody has an answer to.
Rub some hands and thoughts on that.
I would just say we've struggled with those issues of the sand piles, because, and I think that's where there's a lot of public interest with those. I would rely on counsel to give some comment about that particular issue of the railroads.
And Madam Chair, Representative Hansen, from my recollection of the testimony, the piles were problematic, but also the volume of trucks traveling through the city to dump in those piles was problematic. So it's a couple of things going on that needs to be addressed, and it's not certain how we're going to do that yet. The other thing that I did want to talk to the committee about, probably more than the bill author, I personally think that the county aggregate tax is being misapplied. I think the county aggregate tax was intended to be used for road material. and not for silica sand material, even though there are impact on roads. And if we're going to do a tax for silica sand that's going to impact regulation and environmental review and these technical assistant teams, it probably should be a different authority. And I think we should contemplate that as we're moving forward, because I think that the county aggregate tax is being misapplied in this instance.
Or not applied.
Well, it is being applied in Nicollet County and Scott County, and I think they're imposing 15 cents, I believe. And so they're utilizing that for the silica sand mines. And some can argue that gravel and sand are very comparable, but they're totally different uses. And I don't know that when they were putting the aggregate tax language into the law, if they were contemplating silica sand mines or not. I don't know that. My thought process has always been around gravel pits for road material.
Senator Hansen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I think if I understand Senator Scoy correctly, he's talking about the status quo out there right now versus anything we have in the bill. I think what we were trying to do in the bill with the processing and the extraction taxes, those are not related, not aggregate related, but at the local level, we have the aggregate because a loaded truck of sand and a loaded truck of aggregate still hit the road equally amount.
Senator Scott.
Well, Madam Chair and Representative Hansen, you are proposing to increase the aggregate tax from 15 cents to 30 cents. So that hence the discussion about whether that's the appropriate mechanism for raising those dollars or not.
I think, and I will just add, you know, in this whole same set of issues, I think the way the Senate approached some of the TIF bills comes into play, too, as well, some of these old aggregate sites. And I think the bottom line on the House side was, it doesn't matter if we're talking about Representative Hansen's work on silica aggregate, these TIF districts, it shouldn't be the public who's paying for this stuff. And I think as we get into the TIF arguments, that's some of the concern we have, as the industry should be doing repairing the damage to the roads, the reclamation of these sites, whether they want to now turn them into new developments. Tax increment finance has sort of the citizens picking up the tab for that. So we like that the industry should have to pay for all these costs.
And Madam Chair, I think in these prospective permitting that currently being contemplated, that will be the case. I think as they go through the EIS process, which I think just about all of these mines will be going through that process, part of it is that the mine reclamation is part of the original permit. So as they are doing their mining, they will be putting aside the waste material and resources to do mine reclamation. I think it'll be ongoing. And so I expect that'll happen. When you do an EIS for the technical team and for the environmental review work, the proposer pays everything. There is no need for the state to get involved in that because current requirements are for the proposer to pay. And then they will incorporate all their mine reclamation. The difference between what the House or the Senate has in its TIF provisions is that those mines are pretty much mined out. And, you know, so the mine reclamation plan wasn't put in place 30 years ago or 40 years ago or whatever it was. And now somebody has to help with the mine reclamation. The city is coming forward and asking for, you know, their community to help with the mine reclamation. That's different than what's going on with these silica mines, which aren't in place yet.
And I agree, it is different. On the other hand, it makes every resident of the county of which those facilities sit in have to subsidize for new development. So, you know, I think it's part of the policy equation.
Yeah, and I'm not familiar what happened to Southdale and south into Centennial Lakes, who, if they had a TIF district or not, but certainly there is an example of a successful mine reclamation. You know, maybe we should take a look and see how that came about. I honestly don't know.
I think Mr. Michael can tell you if you're interested.
He probably can.
Actually, I just walked around that gravel pit 2 days ago. It's called Centennial Lakes, yes.
Centennial
and,
Lakes,
and Edina, yeah. By the way, I should say, my neighboring community, has not been a big user of tax increment financing, and they're kind of a good role model in that regard. But, Mr. Michael, can you tell us about the gravel pit that was there when I was a kid in Edina that's now Centennial Lakes?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, back in the early 1980s, before the changes that were made in 1988 and 1990, one of the ways that you could qualify a tax increment financing redevelopment district was based on the sort of the soils conditions. And yes, it is, as I recollect, it is the case that there was a gravel pit in Edina, and that Edina created a redevelopment tax increment district and used that to assist with the development of the Centennial Lakes district. The development, the legislature in 1988 and 1990 determined that that was not an appropriate use of redevelopment tax increment because of the fairly lax rules that were criteria that were needed to be met in order to create those districts. There were other places where there was, you know, essentially just grading and filling going on, and those became 25-year redevelopment districts, and so that authority was repealed and restricted.
So back to silica sand.
Back to silica sand.
Because we do want to talk about those TIF districts before the reform. They also didn't pay into fiscal disparity. So there's a list of maybe 40 cities in Minnesota or in the metro that have had developments without having to pay fiscal disparities. People often think the mall would be a new exception. It's not accurate because we've got a list of all the buildings built that didn't pay into fiscal disparities, but that'll be a different day. Silica sand, what else would you like Senate conferees to know, Representative Hansen, as they think about your provisions?
Madam Chair, and I have no comment on TIF at all. I think what we're trying to do here is to recover some of the costs. And I understand, Senator Scully, what you're saying about the Senate approach with the 20-acre EIS. I think what we're, and maybe if I can step back a bit and look at what we've observed over the last few months here at the Capitol with this issue. We have a pretty mature industry in the Minnesota River Valley that has been either mining dimensional limestone or aggregate for some time. They have their long-term Minnesota companies. In general, the local governments appear to be content. Maybe that's because they're getting the aggregate tax, but they're relatively content. We do hear some citizen complaint, but not much. In southeastern Minnesota, where we have unique hydrology, unique natural areas, unique topography, and a lot of sand, we're hearing from local units of government, we're hearing from the citizenry, we have new proposals, expanding proposals, and a variety of sizes of proposals, and we have this issue of storage. Because we have expansion of the industry going on across the river. There's a great deal of public interest. These rooms have been filled, just like they are today, with folks looking for some resolution. What we've tried to do, again, on that basic theme of having the public costs paid for by the private industry, we've tried these methods, and we've adapted them as we've moved through the process. And I think they are still adaptable based on input. But we also have a lot happening right now in Minnesota with this, a lot of demand. We still have folks who want the moratorium. My intent is not to have a de facto moratorium here. My intent is to recover the public cost from the private industry to make that happen. And my intent is not to have a generic environmental impact statement, because we've had those in the past where they take a long bit of time, and I think that we have the capacity to deal with these problems right now. We have a funding mechanism here that I think can recover some of those costs that the public will bear. That the policy side of this that we're dealing in the conference committee that I'm on is going to be grappling with at the same time you're grappling with the funding. The funding pays for the policy. That's our approach. And it can happen right now as we go through this issue, so we can adapt to the issues that are there right now, the demands that are there right now. And I think you know, as we continue this process, we're going to see changes likely. But I think we can recover costs for the local units of government and the state and still have a vibrant industry because we have proximity and because we have high quality and we have the Minnesota way of doing things where we can work collaboratively to make this happen and protect the environment, protect air quality, make sure that the roads are there, deal with the traffic issues that are there. We can do that, but it's going to take the dollars, and we're trying through three different methods here to recover money to make that happen.
Senator Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Hansen, just I'll be real brief. Well, you know, there was a moratorium introduced in the Senate. As I mentioned earlier, I serve on that division, so I was involved in the discussion there. It was obvious that that didn't have the votes to pass. I actually authored an amendment for a mandatory EIS over 20 acres. We had a good discussion about that. My rationale for that was it appeared like the EIS process is the best mechanism to be utilizing, partly because the proposer pays for everything. They pay for the technical team. They pay for the mitigation and all of the mine reclamation support that's needed. That didn't have the votes to pass either, so we ended up with a mandatory EAW over 40 acres, I believe. And I think you're familiar, but for the other members, an EAW is the precursor to an EIS. If you do an EAW, it actually does is a determining mechanism if you need an EIS. So what we kind of...
It doesn't take as long.
It doesn't take as long, but what my... My thought on the whole process was, is that if we could put a mechanism in place that would kind of slow things down through this coming summer, that we could do a study, and there is study language in the Senate division bill, and I don't know what the House has, but I know that the Senate is carrying pretty extensive study and rulemaking language in its environment finance bill. And if we could get through this summer, do that study, hopefully the Department of Revenue in the intervening time will also look at some of this taxation issues so that next year when we come back here, we would have a better handle around what would be necessary. And that's just kind of where I ended up on that. I thought at one point in time that I was actually going to ask the DOR to lead the study. That didn't happen in the Senate. I still think it would have been a good outcome, but it didn't happen. But anyway, I think it's an issue. I think we need to keep working on it. I just don't know if we're quite ready to start imposing taxes when we don't really have the depth of knowledge that we might need to make sure that we're doing it right.
Well, and maybe Representative Hansen has, you know, wants to talk further. Representative Dabney, you know, I think it would be amiss for the legislature to wait another year. In the way, I certainly don't have the knowledge on this that Representative Hansen does, having spent so much time. And I should tell you that as he's gone through the hearing process, the industry, you know, one after another would testify against provisions in his bill and then go on to say how great it's been to work with Representative Hansen because he's been really trying to make this work for everyone. And the reason I think it would be amiss is there are public costs right now that we're not dealing with, and it's gonna continue. I mean, the way I kind of think about it is you've got these folks who are doing this in Minnesota now, and they're pretty good actors, and they're doing it self-contained, and to the extent they're dumping it on rail cars as opposed to using the roads, you know, so that a lot of that's going on. But, you know, it's not quite a gold rush, but, you know, it's sort of a rush now in Minnesota to come in, and, you know, you don't know if who are these folks now and how are they going to conduct themselves and what are they going to be the public costs. And the cost of the, you know, the blow from the piles is indisputable. I mean, it's science. And, you know, roads being damaged. And it's just like any other kind of industry, they should be paying for reclamation and public costs. And, you know, I hadn't put the EAW EIS frame around it because we're just dealing in taxes. But, you know, they're in my understanding of how the EAW EIS and you know, they happen for all kinds of things like the airport runways, the Mall of America has had them. You know, they're not just people think of it environmentally in a real kind of green sense, but they've happened around. I think Target Center might have had one too, actually. But there's a lot of issues related to runoff and how you're going to handle the water from the facility with all the impervious surfaces and all that kind of stuff. You know, those don't really attempt to collect ongoing public costs in a permanent way. Once you've gone through the EIS, I mean, you kind of queue them up so everyone can see them, but short of applying a tax to pay for them, you still need a mechanism to recoup the costs for costs that may be going on. And in fact, they're going on right now in Minnesota. And certainly, I'm sure every one of us of the 10 conferees has an opinion on, you know, from the very green end of the spectrum to the, you know, hey, whatever. I really think Representative Hansen has tried hard to be silent on that. And I will admit I'm probably not a good person to be trustworthy on this because I'm pretty strong environmentalist and pretty green. So there's probably suspicion about my intent, and maybe people think that about Representative Hansen, but it isn't accurate. It's really attempting to say, if we're going to do this, and as we continue to do this, how are the citizens going to be protected that short of some set of taxation, we're all going to pick up the costs of the industry, and that just, to me, doesn't seem fair. So, you know, Representative Dabney spent a lot of time on this, and I don't know if Representative Dabney wants to jump in, but I think we're trying to, those of us who are very green, are environmentally friendly, are trying to set that side of ourselves aside and look at just the tax piece of the puzzle. Representative Dabney?
Thank you, Madam Chair. You know, I'm largely going to echo a number of the comments that you made, particularly about the process in the Property and Local Tax Division, working with Representative Hansen. First of all, you're right. The industry would come down and say, we don't like this, but gosh, we like him. He's a good guy to work with. And through my division, and then I think also in the full committee, the bill was amended and amended and amended to more narrowly target it, to make sure that we weren't capturing those, we weren't capturing new taxes on folks who were doing the right things and in the right way and weren't adding to the public cost, the public environmental cost, the public health cost, the public economic cost. And so we continued to narrow and focus and target the provisions repeatedly through the process. As to the question of the aggregate tax and whether it's appropriate, it kind of reminds me of the old grade school riddle of what weighs more, a pound of feathers or a pound of lead. I think once you put a truck on the public roads, whether it's aggregate or silica sand or feathers, if it weighs whatever it weighs, it has the impact on those roads, whatever that impact is. And I think it's that understanding that brought us to utilize the aggregate tax to recapture the public cost.
Senator Scully.
Just to remind you, I was the author of the amendment for the mandatory EIS. And I strongly believe that would have been the best resolution because that's at least a three-year process. And it would have given us time to contemplate that. Now, I wasn't successful in getting that passed out of the division. But I really think we have, with the EAW language that the Senate is carrying, enough in place. Because anything over, I don't remember, 20 or 40, I know we went around and around about that. But any of those larger scale facilities will have an EAW. And to be honest, with all the discussion going on in the state about this, I find it hard to imagine anybody's going to put in a large-scale silica sand mine without an EIS today, which covers the cost because the proposers pay and also covers all the environmental and other issues. But if we're going to put all of that aside and institute a state tax to generate revenue for, I'm not exactly sure what, because currently when you do an EIS, the proposers pay for everything, so I don't know what the utilization of the revenue is going to be for. We have the local aggregate tax that the counties can impose to help with their road costs, and they seem to be comfortable with that mechanism in many counties. So what are we going to impose the state tax for, and at what rate? Because in this bill, we're at 55 cents a ton. I look at the surrounding states that have any tax at all, and it's all a penny and a half. So, just leaving the discussion of the state tax aside, and leaving aside the discussion of what we're going to do with the money, what's a reasonable rate to be imposing on this? I think it's a huge question. And, you know, the Senate paid attention to surrounding states and
some of our tax proposals that we're carrying this year. We tried to keep in consistency with the surrounding states, and I think that's an issue that we need to be thinking about as we move forward on this. This silica sand is not just found in southeastern Minnesota. It's South Dakota and Oklahoma and, you know, all over the country. And, you know, we've currently got a viable silica sand industry that's been here for years. They've been producing sand for a long time for a multitude of uses that weren't related to oil production. And we don't want to do damage to that industry either. So I think there's a lot here, and we need to understand that as we're moving forward.
Well, I asked Representative Hansen to jump in. I guess, you know, maybe I don't understand the EIS, and that's not the role of this committee, but we don't have a mandatory EIS. But if we did, let's just go with that, I don't believe that covers the ongoing public costs. That's usually not the impact of the EIS. It's to queue them up, but let's say that your amendment that you're telling us about passed and everyone goes through one, that doesn't mean the costs to the public are reclaimed after the EISs are done. That's, you know, during the study, right? But then the study's done and you can have costs for 100 years and the EIS certainly isn't paying for it. The proposal isn't paying for that. So you still need a revenue source to reclaim the ongoing costs. And to the surrounding states issue, I mean, if the cost, say, to Wisconsin is, you know, just for the sake of argument, $5 a head, and they choose to tax $2 a head worth and have their general fund eat $3 a head worth, that's a policy decision they can make. I'm less concerned about the surrounding price as to what is the true cost to the people of Minnesota, and that's what the tax should be set at. And I know we're kind of guessing because people don't really know, but I think the people who are doing it now are a good measure because they tend to be doing it the way I think we would want them to do it, and so we already have some pretty good information about what it's costing. And at least, you know, if you have some regulation and standard around it, then you should be able to recoup that cost, independent of what another state might be charging. If it costs your citizenry $100 million a year, then the industry should pay $100 million a year. If it's $5 million a year, it should pay $5 million a year. You know, that's less important to me. So, but I don't think the EIS would address the ongoing public costs anyhow.
Well, the aggregate tax that I think is misapplied is doing that currently. It's 15 cents.
I mean, not everyone's imposing it.
Well, but that's a local decision.
Well, we could change that. Make it a state requirement.
Well, that would be something to contemplate. Mm-hmm. I think it would be a better outcome than imposing a statewide tax, which I'm not exactly sure would be beneficial to the locals. You know, we've had a lot of discussion about host community in the Senate Tax Committee this year, and, you know, I'm much more concerned about the host community than I am the state in this area.
Well, and Senator Scoia, on that, and that's not that, you know, but it's puzzling, isn't it? Then why are some who are given the ability to impose that tax not doing it?
Yeah, I don't have the answer for why they made that decision.
Yeah. Representative Hansen, did you want to?
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. And on that particular point, we did have testimony that there were some of the affected counties in the southeast that hadn't opposed the tax. So I think Representative Dabney has tried to deal with that in the extraction tax, that if they choose not to, I mean, there is still public cost that's occurring there. And I understand and support local control, but, you know, you also have varying degrees of willingness at certain times to do certain things. And so I want to get back to, what does this pay for? What does this pay for? In the bills, 906 was the House file, and that's in the environmental finance. We have rulemaking, and rulemaking costs money, because we don't have the reclamation standards that we can. A local government and a specific project can have reclamation things, but it does not have, we don't have the rulemaking completed for reclamation. We don't have the similar thing for air quality. Health department has been looking at air quality standards. Those things cost money. If we have them, direct them to do it, and they don't have the funds that are in here, they've got to take it from somewhere else. And so there are upfront costs to deal with the issue right now to try to get a handle on that through the rulemaking and through the EQB. We've had a debate, I think, in both bodies about the role of the Environmental Quality Board, whether it's a role that each agency should take on its own. We decided that the Environmental Quality Board was the place to bring the agencies together so that they can coordinate. As we went through the fiscal note for the cost of 906, we learned that the way the fiscal note was prepared was assuming that we would hire a number of new people to be sitting there waiting for that call to come in. So on the House floor, we directed that they use existing. The intent that I've had throughout this is not to hire a lot of new staff that are there to respond, but to use the expertise we have, whether it's in the DNR or the Department of Transportation, or whether it's in the University of Minnesota or the Minsky campuses, to pull them together when there's a project where a local government may not have the staff or may need folks to come in, like we've done with the wetland technical evaluation panels, so that they can come in and provide that technical expertise for the local government to make the right decision. Those things cost money. That's the cost we have in there. We create a local library of ordinances. I think in the Senate you have that as an online library. That was our intent in the House as well, so that we have the tools there, and the EQB can bring those resources together for the local governments or the industry or the citizens to respond to this growing industry. And the industry, I believe, will grow. I think it's going to grow because we can do things better here than we have an experience that we can apply to make things work. And it's going to take some money up front, and it's going to take the ongoing money, and it's going to take the monitoring and the evaluation and the assessment to make sure that things continue to work after these things are set up.
Senator Skoy.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Hansen, the Senate does include money for those rulemaking provisions. We are more willing to use general fund dollars. And so that's where we achieve those dollars. And I actually think it's a more appropriate mechanism. I think you get a more fair tax system if we can stay away from these, as many of these dedicated kind of things as we can, and have more of a general tax policy that's, you know, our income and our sales taxes. But we do fund that, but we use general fund money.
Madam Chair.
Representative Dabney.
Madam Chair, Senator Skoy and Representative Hansen, you might be able to help me with this, but as the Hansen bill came to the division, it had three dedicated pots of money for specific purposes. Money went to deal with protection of wellheads.
Yep.
This was new vocabulary for me. But protection of wellheads, it went to DNR for land acquisition in
easements.
I'm sorry?
And easements.
And easements. And Representative Hansen, can you help me with the third?
I think we had it.
Roads.
We were using it to fund the
MnDOT.
MnDOT.
And we thought about it for a bit and came down largely to the same spot you are, that rather than have all of the proceeds from these taxes be dedicated to those specific things, have them flow into the general fund, and then have the relevant committees and relevant agencies come back and say, okay, here's the public cost of silica sand mining and the need to protect wellheads, and so give us money out of the general fund rather than out of dedicated funds. I think the pieces that are left are very narrow and specific and are about better understanding the impact of this growing industry so that we can act more on a firmer policy base going forward. So we have significantly narrowed the dedication since Representative Hansen's first bill.
Senator Skoy.
Well, I think I'm getting done with my commentary on this. The only other thing with regard to the wellhead protection, and this is something that I talked to a number of commissioners about, and I talked to some of the agency people. In one of the communities I represent, their drinking water is, you know, obviously in a wellhead protection area, and it's covered by farm fields. Well, all of that activity in that wellhead protection area is regulated by the Department of Ag. They're telling those farmers what they can and they cannot do. Now they do it jointly in discussions with the city and the department and all of this. And so knowing that that wellhead protection is there, I find it hard to believe that some state agency, whether it's DNR or pollution control or somebody, isn't going to, under their current authority, regulate these sand mines. I mean, there has to be within the water regulations or something that they're going to be regulated. And so I don't necessarily see the need for all of this additional language with regard to those things. But, you know, that's the reason for the study. And hence, and I know you don't want to wait any more time because you think that we need to do that this year. But I think we'll make a better decision if we have a better understanding of that. And I really don't think people have that yet. But that's just me, I guess.
Well, thank you for listening, and thank you, Representative Hansen, for being here. And Senator Senjum, please, yes. Sorry, didn't see you.
And thank you, Madam Chair. Not to belabor it, but maybe just a little bit, and perhaps if members might just refer to page 188, lines 29 through 33, where it talks about the special revenue fund and then the purposes, and one of them being a model standard, which I suppose is a model ordinance, as I don't know that for sure. But it goes on to then to talk about technical assistance to counties and other governments and assistance to counties. My point is that, if not, you know, this is about the first exposure to any of this I've had, but that seems to be what the money is for, I think. And in some ways, you know, I wonder what technical assistance is, you know, beyond a call desk, or are there teams of people, or could it even be a state agency which sets up a sub-office in a county helping people? And so my question, is there any limits at all to any of this that you've thought about in terms of how far into so-called technical assistance the state government might get in terms of being a resource to the county? There's other assistance to counties, which seems like that's the all everything, whatever they want, we might be able to provide as long as we have the money. But maybe just some thoughts on that.
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Senator Senjum. That's primarily in House File 906, and then it's been carried forward in the Environmental Finance Bill. And I have the fiscal note here from 906, and I can hand that to you on my way out that kind of defines that a little bit.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you. And we were just hoping, you know, I know we're going to try to be done at recess at noon. If we can have Mr. Michael walk through our estate and gift tax provisions, and maybe just to get through them so you can hear them, and we can discuss them maybe later. But at least we can get them on the table. Thank you, Representative Hansen. We
Thank
appreciate you.
You
being here. So Mr. Michael, did you want to join us and tell us, maybe someone can tell us where we're looking in the bill?
And Madam Chair.
Senator Scott.
Madam Chair, we did do a fair amount of work and carried for a while a provision dealing with portability of estate taxes.
Oh.
And also we contemplated for a while whether we should decouple from the federal code to eliminate the rate bubble that is there. So I don't know if Mr. Michaels can talk about whether any of this is accomplished or not.
Okay.
It's not on our spreadsheet any longer, but it was there for a while.
Mr. Michael.
And
I think you have to pull your mic closer.
Right. Madam Chair, members of the committee, find where these...
Maybe off the side-by-side is really the best way to... it's Article 7.
Yes, it's...
Page 46.
Right.
The side-by-side.
I think it's page 118 on the bill, if you want, if, for those
115.
Of you who want to look
through,
at the bill.
He's going to go through all those.
Right.
He'll go through all those. It's a big amount. Okay, Mr. Michael, thank you.
Right.
So page 46 of the side-by-side, is that where we're at?
Correct.
Okay.
Yeah, and on the House bill, the provisions start on 115. And I think it's probably useful to just talk conceptually about there are four differences between the Senate bill and the House bill. Both the Senate bill and the House bill make a variety of clarifying changes in these definitions of qualified small businesses and qualified farms that are nearly identical in both bills. The only difference between the House bill and the Senate bill on those provisions is that for qualified farms, which is largely homestead farmland, the House bill makes it explicit that relative homesteads qualify for that, whereas the Senate bill is silent on that. So if the committee wants to think about deciding between those two provisions, ultimately that's one thing to keep in mind about the differences.
Okay, Senator Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Mr. Michaels, does our changes that we made in the way we classify ag homestead, the cleanup language that we have, would that address that issue also, because we're making changes to who can qualify?
Madam Chair, Senator Scoey, it would eliminate several classes of property that currently qualify that could therefore not qualify under the House bill, but you still have the issue that you do still have some relative homesteads that qualify. And I know one of the arguments that, well, there are two issues to consider in this context. One is the practitioners have come and argued that the relative homestead changes would be useful because there are some of these owners that, you know, are becoming now frail and want to move into assisted living or into the town, and that you don't want the sort of the estate tax implications of that to sort of drive those kinds of decisions. The other thing is that the way the language in the original bills were drafted, it's likely that there's enough ambiguity that this could be litigated, and so I think the department would like clarity one way or another. So if we decide to go with your provisions, we should probably then clarify that, yeah, relative homesteads don't qualify. So on those sort of more, you know, sort of mundane or technical, they're not really technical, but on those clarifying changes, that's something the committee ought to keep in mind. Otherwise, the House bill has three main differences from the Senate bill on the estate and gift tax provisions. The first of these relates to property that's held in pass-through entities. So here we're talking about things like S corporations, limited liability companies, and partnerships.
And is that in Section 2, Mr. Michael?
Madam Chair, Senator Ress, the definition provisions are in Section 2. And then there are also related provisions that are in Section 4 and Section 3. But the heart of the provisions are in Section 2. And the situation with this is that if I'm a non-resident and I own real property, for example, in Minnesota, let's say I'm a Minnesota resident who's decided to relocate to Florida, and I've changed my residence, and I'm now a Florida resident. And here we're talking about non-business property, but just normal property. But I still own a valuable home in Minnesota. Let's say it's $1 million-plus home. If under current law, if I just retain the ownership of that home or my seasonal rec cabin in my own name, that is real property that's subject to the Minnesota estate tax, so that when I die, I would be required to file a Minnesota estate tax return and report the home that I owned, that I still own in Minnesota, the cabin, as Minnesota property and pay estate tax on that. However, if I instead choose to form an LLC and convey that property into an LLC, then the ownership of that property has now become an intangible. And because our tax only taxes intangibles that are owned by residents, that property then no longer becomes taxable. And so in that instance, if I've been wise enough to put my home and my cabin into an LLC or an S-corp or a partnership, that escapes Minnesota estate taxation. What the House bill says, we will look through those arrangements and say, in that case, we're going to treat your ownership of the LLC as if you actually own the property that the LLC owns. And so that then you will still owe, as a non-resident, Minnesota estate tax on that property.
Yeah. Senator Rest.
So, Madam Chair, Mr. Michaels, do other states follow that that principle to ignore the sham of the organizational entity? Senator Scoyan and I have had this discussion before. In terms of treating the underlying property as part of the estate.
Madam Chair, Senator Rest, to my knowledge, and I've spent a lot of time reading the estate and inheritance taxes in other states, to my knowledge, only one other state does this, and that's the state of Maine. But the other thing to keep in mind is that estate and inheritance taxes are now becoming uncommon among the states. It's, you know, the norm is to not have an inheritance or an estate tax. So anyway, just to follow up on this, we're not just talking about these instances.
Madam Chair.
Oh, I'm so sorry.
Before you go on from that point, Mr. Michaels, so you're an S-stock and you have shares and you're a non-resident that has a cabin in Minnesota. And that cabin then is owned by the S-stock. So that value of that cabin is included in the value of your shares. What happened to the share transfer on your death if you're a non-Minnesota resident?
Madam Chair, Senator Scoy, in general, somehow your estate plan, whether that's your will or whether it's a trust document or something like that, would provide for the ownership transfer of your ownership in the S corp, for example, or the LLC, and so whatever those plans provide for, that's who would inherit it. But with an estate tax, it really doesn't matter unless it's your surviving spouse that inherits, because the estate tax sort of says what's the sum of the value of all of the property in your estate at the time of the death, and then we'll subtract out transfers to the surviving spouse because they're exempt. And we'll also subtract out costs of administration and charitable contributions. But otherwise, it's that residual that we impose the tax on. But you may have a situation, and we'll get to this also applies to businesses. So if you own a business and you are a non-resident, now you may never have never been a Minnesota resident, but you still own a business in Minnesota. The house provision will look through and say, we're going to look at the real property and the tangible property in Minnesota that this business owns, if it's a pass-through entity, mm-hmm. and we're going to attribute that to you, and you're going to have to, your estate will have to file a Minnesota return and pay tax on that. But in many business instances, and some of these other instances, you may have multiple owners of these pass-through mm-hmm. entities. And in that case, the language says it's in proportion to your capital ownership under under federal tax rules that we follow for Minnesota purposes for income tax. Everybody's got a capital account in a pass-through entity, and that capital account has to be maintained over time. So as you make additions or, sell property, there are adjustments to that. And so that would determine essentially how much the decedent owns and how much goes into the estate, and would therefore, there'd be valuation issues, obviously, with all of these mm-hmm. things that you always have to deal with in estate tax purposes because, it's like, what's all of this property worth?
And so, Madam Chair, Mr. Michaels, so how would that work when the individual is not required to file a federal estate tax because they're below the federal de minimis? What would happen in that scenario where we don't have the federal guidance?
That's right.
Madam Chair or Senator Scoy, the same thing that happens for a resident who has less than $5 million in property and is not required to file a 706 for federal purposes. There would be a filing requirement. Now, what you're alluding to, and which is accurate, there's a little bit of a challenge for this for the Department of Revenue to say, how are we going to find these residents that own, you know, an S-Corp or an LLC that owns Minnesota real property? And so, yes, there's an audit challenge with this because they're not filing a federal 706 that immediately tells the Revenue Department, hey, there's a taxable estate. Now, many of these, particularly when we're talking about the businesses, I think in many of those instances, they will, you know, have 706s filed, and the department will know about it, and the practitioners will also know to file a Minnesota return. But that's always a challenge with provisions like this.
And, Madam Chair, Mr. Magnus, but the lake cabin example probably would go under the radar screen mostly. I mean, there aren't very many lake cabins that are worth $5 million probably.
Right.
Your questions highlight, and I hope when you hear about all the rest of this and all these provisions, this is a very progressive piece of our house tax bill, and we're really trying to, you know, we know we have some regressive taxes in there, and these work together in a very progressive way within the house tax bill.
It will be interesting to hear what the department says about the administration of them.
Just to follow up, the final piece on this pass-through entity ownership taxation is, now if the owner of this, again, we're always talking about non-residents, so these are individuals who are not living in Minnesota, they're living in another state. If that state imposes an estate or an inheritance tax, which they have the constitutional right to do on the full value of the property that's owned, they would typically, as Minnesota does, treat this as an intangible and tax it. So to cover that situation so there's not essentially a claim that this is sort of unfair double taxation, there's a credit that's provided that says that if the same value was taxed by the state of your domicile, so let's say you're a New York resident or a Connecticut resident, both of which have estate or inheritance taxes, then we would credit you for the amount of the New York tax that you pay on this Minnesota value so that there's no double tax, just to finish out the last piece of that. Okay, so two more provisions, which I hope I should be able to cover in the remaining 9 minutes before you recess. The third piece also is the last two pieces are both gift taxes, but the first piece of this is really a modification to the estate tax. And this, the way the estate tax is now, it includes only the value of the property that you own when you die. So, for example, if you've given away property shortly before death or a long time before death, that's outside of your estate, and that's not included in the value of the property that is subject to Minnesota tax. Now, what that creates the opportunity for is if someone is in a situation where you know that within a relatively finite period of time you're going to die. Not nice to talk about. But there's a strong incentive to make what's called a deathbed gift, because if you make a deathbed gift, suddenly that property will be outside of the estate and will escape Minnesota estate tax. And that tax can be quite substantial, since most of it ends up paying at rates up to 16%, and anything over $10 million is 16%. Now, one of the things, because the federal tax has a $5 million exemption and the Minnesota tax has a $1 million exemption, you can give up to $5 million. There's a similar $5 million exemption under the federal gift tax without incurring federal gift tax liability or the obligation to do that. And now, all states that have had estate and inheritance taxes that were not just pickup taxes like Minnesota has, all have rules that are called gift in contemplation of death to prevent this incentive from happening. Minnesota had a rule like this back when we had our own estate and inheritance taxes. We repealed it when we went to a gift tax because it became irrelevant. But what the House bill says, that if you make a gift within 3 years of when you die, that gift will then be pulled back into your estate and included, so that there's not this incentive to make deathbed gifts. And, of course, there are other reasons to discourage people from making deathbed gifts, because frequently, as one can guess, folks like that oftentimes don't have the capacity because, you know, dementia is so common now. And, of course, you have the possibility of undue influence as the potential heirs gather around and, you know.
Give me the farm.
So anyway, they're independent reasons to not encourage making deathbed gifts. So that's the second thing that's different than what's in the Senate bill. The third thing
Where's
is that
in the on the side by side?
Mr.
What
Michael,
which section is that?
Section 9.
There are
section
several provisions
nine,
that relate
ten.
To this. There's section 1 and section
9.
And then the actual total gift tax stuff comes on starting in section 9, which I'm going to talk about. About next, but it's largely sections 1, 2, and 3. That's the estate tax part of the gifts and contemplation of death.
And that's at the top of page 48, that look back
right.
requirement.
Correct.
Right.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
And the final thing that the House bill does is that it actually reenacts a true gift tax, so that individuals who make gifts in excess of $1 million over their lifetime would be subject to a 10% gift tax. Minnesota, back in the 70s, for a long period of time, from the 30s through the 70s, had a gift tax. And again, as we went to a pure pickup estate tax, that was repealed. So this gift tax would mirror the same exemption level as the estate tax, but it would be at a lower rate. Since the estate tax is at 16% and the gift tax is at 10%, there still would be an incentive to make lifetime gifts as a way to minimize your estate tax liability. And there's a strong incentive under the federal tax system to do that, too. You can really minimize your transfer tax by making gifts during your lifetime as opposed to after, you know, having transfers upon death. And the reason for that, at the federal level, they have the same rate schedule, but it's tax exclusive rather than inclusive. And so as you think about it, the tax is applied to the gift, but whereas at the estate tax, it's applied including the amount of the gift. So the gift pulls it out of the estate. It's a little confusing, but there's still a substantial savings for doing lifetime gifts rather than allowing transfers upon your death.
Would you just repeat that one more time? I'm not clear on some of that. The estate, who is giving you the benefit of the gift tax, the federals? And would the House proposal give the comparable benefit or not?
Madam Chair, Senator Scoey, the House proposal actually has a bigger benefit than the federal, because the federal has the same rate schedule for both taxes, but because of the way the tax is levied, in other words, you make the gift and it's out of the estate, and so therefore the tax is, you know, not on top of it, but it's excluded. That's the benefit of making the lifetime gifts. All of this gets then pulled back in, and you get a credit for the gift tax that you paid against your estate tax, and so that gift tax is out of the estate, and so you don't pay tax on the gift tax that you paid and the growth and the value of that over time. And so, but the House has an even bigger benefit in that the rate schedule is lower. It's got a flat 10% rate, whereas under the Minnesota estate tax, the effective rate is 16% generally. So there's still an incentive to make gifts.
And the gift tax is over $1 million and also anything within 3 years of death. I mean, you can give $14,000 a year up to $1 million.
Per person.
If you do it for 30 years, whenever you'll get there, you know.
Yeah.
Or within 3 years of death. Am I
right.
correct on that?
So right.
3 years.
Before 3 years would be exempt if it's under $1 million.
Right.
Correct.
Right. 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 Right.
Right.
Within
right.
the 3 years. Right.
And Madam Chair, Senator Scoey, the other thing to note about, as you pointed out, there's an annual gift tax per recipient exemption, which would not, you know, these are federally taxable gifts, so you have to be over that $14,000 annual exemption before you're subject to the proposed gift tax. So that's out.
Okay.
And the three-year rule, that pulls the gift into the estate, and you get a credit for the gift tax that you paid, but, of course, the estate tax rate is higher, so you're going to end up paying more.
And thank you, Madam Chair. Okay, that has answered some of my questions. And then, again, it's the $14,000 per year is right now, and that's an exemption per person, and so it's the $14,000 per person and then up to?
Madam Chair, Senator Dietzick, yes, that's correct. So it's $14,000. And for a married couple, there's a what's called a gift-splitting rule, so you can essentially have one individual make it, but the other spouse recognizes it. So it's effectively for a married couple, it's $28,000 per recipient per year.
Senator Dietzick? Other questions? If not, I don't know when we'll come back, but we're going to recess, and we appreciate you learning about our provisions. And we can take this up again if we have more questions, because we're on the floor. So we're going to recess. Thank you.
Exciting.
It doesn't matter much to me because I